So we are on the page marked Chaf Hei at the top, dealing with, and this will be the topic the entire time tonight, dealing with the topic that we call Sidur. Sidur meaning arrangement. And again, just to review, what we're talking about is a borrower who defaults on a debt. The lender has the right to go to court, Beit Din, Jewish court, and say, I want you to go into this person's assets and take payment of the debt, and the court is able to go in and collect, so long as they are misader, they arrange on his behalf that he gets to keep what are called the basics. Not because he has a right to them. Technically speaking, you borrow money from somebody, you pledge to repay, you have to repay. However, it seems, based on some of the things we saw last week, and based on the way the text works in general, and the sources work in general, it seems like what we're suggesting is that when you borrow money, you have in mind, and the lender understands, that certain things are not up for collection. Certain things are going to be kept for the borrower. So what we've defined so far is 30 days worth of food or money to buy 30 days worth of food, 12 months of clothing, so he has clothing for the various seasons of the year, certain basics he gets to keep. Last time we talked about tools of his trade and the ability to keep the tools of the trade. We talked about what he would have to rent out to others in order to bring in money for payment of the debt. This has been already a long discussion. So now, we have one point to finish up from last time that we didn't get to last time. And that is on the third of the lines on the lower part of the page, page Chaf Hei. Okay, so we're looking at this sheet here, where you see the big letters Vav, Bet, Shin, Vav, and Taf, Ubishut, towards the beginning of the line there. Ubishut Maharit Chelek Aleph Simen Kuf Yud Gimel. He quotes a responsum, goes back to, I believe, the 14th century, by Rabbi either Yeshaya or Yosef Ditrani, I forget which this is, but Kasav, he wrote, She'ein Motzian Oso Mibeso Shehu Darbo Ad Yud Beis Chodesh. You may recall that last time we had a discussion about whether you would evict someone from his house in order to claim the house for payment of the debt. And we saw two different views. Well, three different views, really. One view was, yes, he loses the house. Second view, Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chiel Mechel Epstein, said, not if it's going to humiliate him, leaving him out on the street, that he's not expected to lose. And then a third view, which said, he retains ownership of the house, but he's required to rent it out to bring in money for payment of his obligations. He's not allowed to simply leave the lender high and dry. So now what the Maharit is going to do is he's going to modify the view that says that he is in fact removed from the home. He says, Ein motzi en osa mi beiso shehu darbo ad yud beis chodesh. You do not evict him from the place in which he lives for 12 months. Dumya diksus shenostim lo yud beis chodesh. Just like he gets to keep 12 months of clothing, he also gets to live in the house for an additional 12 months. So he writes, V'tzarech iyun liyashev divrei maharit im divrei harashbas. The Pischei Choshen, who is the one who's recording this, says that you have to analyze this within the context of the view of Rashba, who we saw last time, who said you're renting it out. Does that mean that Rashba would say, wait 12 months and then rent it out? Is that part of his view, or is this a different school of thought? Umikomakom, but he says still, however you do it, Av ledas maharit, even within the view of maharit, nirash she'eino tzarech lahashir lo kim diras benoni, v'rak lo v'lo levnei beiso dumya diksus. He says 2 points. Number one, whatever you would have to leave this person for dwelling would be an average dwelling. So in other words, if he owns a mansion, so he doesn't get to say, well, I'm staying in my mansion for 12 months. That doesn't work. Because remember that regarding clothing, we said we don't leave him fancy clothing. We said whatever is considered normal and average is what he gets to have. He doesn't have to live as a pauper, but he doesn't get to live in luxury either. Same thing for the house. In the event that he has some luxurious estate, we're going to say to him, rent that out, and instead we'll rent you an apartment somewhere. Something average. That's one point that he makes. And the other point that he makes goes back to the discussion that we had already a few weeks ago, which is regarding his wife. The situation with his wife is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, anything that his wife has that's independent of him remains hers and can't be claimed for the debt. So we said, for example, if he bought his wife jewelry and it's hers now, that cannot be taken as payment of the debt. On the other hand, if he says, well, you can't move me out of the house, what's my wife going to do? The answer is, too bad. That's not the lender's problem. The lender is the one who is really nice. Remember that. This is a very important rule to remember all through our discussion about claiming payment of debts. Lending within Jewish law is an act of tzedakah. It's an act of philanthropy. Remember, you're not allowed to charge interest. This is, lending is considered to be an act of tzedakah. That's why it's presented in the Torah. So therefore, when he says, well, what about my poor wife? The answer is, we feel really bad for her, but the lender shouldn't suffer for his act of tzedakah. Someone will have to take care of her. Remember, we also said that it's a mitzvah of tzedakah for anybody to help out, but you can't say to the lender, that's your personal responsibility. Imagine if you did, right? Let's imagine a situation in which we actually did turn to the lender and say, you are now going to be responsible to worry about the borrower's family. What would be the result? People won't lend money. No one's going to want to do this anymore. Because who's going to want to enter into a situation in which now I lend somebody money, that's my first sin, so to speak, and now I have to worry and take care of his family also. You'll freeze all lending. That's the end of credit. So that's something that we'd like to avoid. This is our mysterious last participant. Okay, there you go. So that's just a wrap up from last time. We now move to our new topic, which is on the top of the page that says Chafei. You want the top of this page?
Okay. Jordan, which page?
You can share here. Okay, the same page still. We now get to a new point. We've been talking about somebody who lends money to somebody else, and then somebody else defaults. And we said, if he defaults on the loan, so you make certain provisions for him, but beyond that, you're going to collect his assets. But you leave him certain things. That's because, as I said before, it's a given, when you extend a loan to somebody, that certain things are not going to be up for you for collection. That's fine. But what about the following scenario? Guy wants to lend somebody money. He's willing to do it. But he says, I'm not sure this fellow's going to pay me back. So what I'm going to do is, I am going to demand that he swear that he's going to pay me back. He has to take a shavua. He has to take an oath that he's going to pay me back. Nowadays, you listen to that and you sort of laugh, because people don't take their word very seriously, unfortunately. But historically, that was a very big deal. People who would justify for themselves, perhaps, being unethical and saying, I'm not going to pay back, when it came to an affair between themselves and another human being, if they had sworn in the name of God that they're going to pay back, then they would take that seriously. So the lender says to the borrower, I want you to take an oath. The borrower says, sure, and takes the oath. So that's the case we're dealing with now. Hanishba lefroa, if somebody swears that he's going to pay back, ein bo din sidur. Then the law of sidur, the law that says that we arrange for him to keep certain things for himself, does not apply. V'chayav limkor kol asher lo v'lo yavor al shavuaso. He will be obligated to sell off whatever he has rather than violate his oath. And the reason is because it's understood when you take such an oath, that applies to everything. You're saying, I'm going to give from whatever I have. We know that a person is able to do this. We're going to revisit this a little bit later. But we know it because of a case we already gave. We talked about a month and a half ago, the ksuba. Right? We said that normally a creditor is not allowed to require a borrower to get a job in order to pay off a debt. The borrower doesn't have assets. The creditor is not within his rights to say to him, you have to go get a job, become a ditch digger, work at the supermarket counter, whatever it is. Can't do that. That's the rule. However, there is a certain creditor who can do that. It's not really a creditor. And that is one's wife. A man's wife is able to say that to him. Why? Because in the ketubah, it says there, he promises, Vana Eflach, I am going to work to feed and support you. So therefore, she can hold him to his contract. Similarly here, if a person takes an oath, what he's essentially doing as part of the oath is waiving his right to have certain things protected. By taking that oath, he's saying, everything I have is going to be up for it because I have to fulfill my oath to God. That's the idea that the Pesach Choshen is presenting at the top of the page. Sure.
Somewhere in the Torah it says that
you
should not take away their clothes or something.
Right.
Is that...
Right, so you're right. So the rule is indeed that the Torah does mention a couple of times, once in Parshat Mishpatim, once in Parshat Re'eh, that you are not allowed to take a collateral from someone else's clothing. So in other words, I'm not allowed to say to him, I want your clothing, and if I do, there is also the possibility, if he needs something only at night, I have to return it to him when he's going to need it, and then come back for it, and so on. So that's true. However, here we're not dealing with collateral. No, here we're talking about actually payment of the debt.
He swears, so whatever he got, he has to sell him here. So
well, no, because he keeps 12 months of clothing. There are certain things that I can't touch. Yeah. So take a look now on your sheet. Actually, take a look at the second sheet that I gave you, the one that has the English at the top of the page. This is a comment made by Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, leading rabbi from the 18th century. In his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law on business law, his commentary is called the Urim V'Tumim. So this is from the part called the Tumim. There are two different parts to it. And he's commenting on the rule that says that somebody who swears to pay is in fact offering up all of his assets. And he says, not so fast. Din zeh, he writes in Aleph, din zeh eino muskam. He says, not everybody agrees with this. Why? The Hakas of HaRivash, he quotes you the Rivash. The Rivash is Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Sheshet Perfet, rabbi in, I believe it's either 15th or 16th centuries, in one of those, in Barcelona, I think. And he deals a lot in his responsa with financial matters and issues of debts in particular. Apparently he received a lot of questions in this on this subject. So he wrote in a responsa, Hanishba lefro ve'enlo, somebody swears that he's going to pay, and he doesn't have assets. Ein lecha ones gadol mizeh. So he says, this is what we call ones. Ones means circumstances beyond your control. So he says, there's no greater circumstance beyond your control than having nothing to give. Umayase, what should he do? Yigzol o yignov kedei lekayim shvu aso. Should he steal in order to fulfill his oath? Right, that would be corrupt. You steal in order to satisfy the oath. Right, robbing Peter to pay Paul, quite literally. The Visiyem and the Rivash concluded, Aval osin lo kefiyase der shakasa harambam perek beiz mehechos malveh b'mishatan she'elo b'mayifrachovo. He says, what you do for such a person is sidur, so you leave him all the things that you leave somebody regularly who borrowed and can't afford to pay. You take what he has except, you leave certain things. So the Rivash, Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Sheshet, says very explicitly that even the person who swore does not have to pay everything. Ad kan l'shono, end of quote, he says. Hare de kasav lahedya de misadrin lo. So he wrote explicitly that we do, in fact, make arrangements for this person. We don't take everything. Vare kan machlokes aposkim. So he says, you see that this is, in fact, subject to debate. And now the Tumim, Rabbi Eibeshitz, says, I am going to prove that the Rivash is correct. He says, "V'lichor raya brura ledivrei harivash." He says there is a clear proof to the words of the Rivash. It should say ledivrei, not lelivrei. That's an OCR problem in scanning the PDF. He says there is proof to the position of the Rivash. D'maishna shavua mineder. Technically, there are two different types of oath in Jewish law. One is an oath that is an action, saying "I will do X" or "I won't do X." And then that's called a shivu'ah. And then there is a neder, which is about an object. A neder is when one says a certain object is going to be off limits to him. I won't use such and such, or I will dedicate such and such to the temple. That's called a neder. Shivu'ah is about an action. Neder is about an object. So, he says there's no difference between the two in terms of these rules that we're talking about. Shivu'ah and neder are the same. So he says, if you're telling me someone has to roll in the dust, so to speak, in order to fulfill his oath, giving away everything he has, then presumably the same thing would be true if he took a neder. There's no reason to distinguish. Okay, he's clearly springing a trap on you. So far you agree with me that Shavua and Neder should have the same rules, and you agree that if somebody who took a Shavua type of oath would have to sell off everything, so too the person who took a Neder would have to sell off everything to satisfy the Neder. So he says, V'im Kain, well, if so, He says, let's say someone took a neder then. And he said, I owe $100 to the temple, to the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. The person took such an oath. Then you would tell me that he's obligated to roll in the dust, so to speak, liquidate any assets he has in order to pay off his vow. Velama kaimalan. Well, then why is it that we in fact say chayve arachin v'haomer haray aleimana lebedek habayis misadrin lo? We say that if a person promised an erech, which is a certain type of donation, or a person pledged $100 to the temple, we still do employ sidur for him. That's the rule. He says that's black letter law. That goes back to Talmudic times. So he says, I don't understand. If you're telling me that oaths are not subject to sidur, we're not going to help out the guy who took the oath, then I want to know why in the case of somebody who vowed to give a certain amount to the temple, suddenly we are willing to help the guy out. We don't say he has to roll in the dust to fulfill his vow. He says something which expresses a deep awareness of the way things work in the Gemara, the way things work in the Talmud. As a general rule, the Talmud has a rule when you're dealing with debts to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple. The rule is the house always wins. That's the rule. You will never come out of a situation like that ahead. If you make a vow to give something to the temple's always going to win. If you owe a tithe, if there's some kind of doubt regarding what you owe, the temple's always going to win. And the reason for that is because you don't want a situation in which you are holding something that really belongs to God. That's a very bad idea. So because of that, you're always going to err on the side of giving. That's a principle in general. So he says, but that's not what's going on over here. You're telling me that if someone takes a vow to dedicate something to the temple, we're going to let him keep 12 months worth of clothing, a month worth of food, and all these other things, tools of the trade. If it's that's a God, we're going to go easy on him. Whereas if he swore that he's going to pay to another human being, then we're not going to let him keep all these things. You're giving God less power than you give the human being. That's not normally the way things are done in this province. He says that doesn't fit. Velochei Nero, he says, therefore it appears to me, Devadai ledina tzadku divrei harivash. As a matter of law, the rivash is correct. Dekevan deshuras hadin misadrin. That since, by letter of the law, the rule is that we are misader, that we do make arrangements for a debtor. V'atara amra devarim elu lo yihiyu bichlala peraon. And the Torah says these things should not be subject to collection of the debt. So his debt should, his oath should not apply to those items. Because when he took the oath, he only meant to pay with that which is subject to collection for the debt. But if it's not something that's normally collected, that wasn't what he had in mind. That's the Tumim's position. So the Tumim and the Rivash say that they disagree with the position that we recorded here, which comes from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, that says that an oath, once a person takes an oath, everything is fair game for collection. So it's a debate. We have a machlokes, we have a debate. So now, take a look back on the other sheet, please, the one that has Chaf Hey at the top. We are in the lower portion of the page, we are on the sixth line, where it says Nunchet in parentheses. He gives you the source for the rule that we can collect everything from this person, Shulchan Aruch, Siman Tzadi, Zayin, Seif Lamed. And then he says, V'ayeinu Tumim, see the Tumim. That's Rabbi Yonasan Ibishitz, who we just saw. Shekasav, he wrote, Shaharivash Sover, that the Rivash believes, Sha'av Kishanishba Mashirim Lo Kidin Sidur, that even if somebody swore, nonetheless, we will let him keep this sidur, we will let him keep the clothing, the food, and so on. But if you were to continue in the Tumim, I didn't go that far with it, you would find that he suggests that the reason why the Shulchan Aruch takes the view that in fact you collect everything is not because we know for sure that you should, but simply because we are in doubt about whether he has a right to keep it or not. And when you're in doubt, again, you're dealing with the temple, in this case, you're not dealing with the temple, you're dealing with having taken an oath. So in doubt, we're going to say, you know what, pay up. You're better off that than breaking your oath. But then he continues to say the following. Upashut, the large letters there, the word upashut, it's the tenth of the lines in the bottom portion of the page. He says, it is obvious. Shalachar shamachar o higbal of alchov. V'lo hishir lo yoser midin sidur. He says, this person who took the oath and then gave everything, he didn't keep anything for himself, he gave it all up, and he still doesn't have enough to pay. So we don't consider him to be a violator of his oath. There's no penalty for him, because there ain't nothing else there. There's nothing you can do. It's an ones situation. It's against his will. I'm jumping over the parentheses. He says, "V'kasa b'nesivos hamishpat simin lamedalid." The nesivos wrote, Rabbi Yaakov Lorberbaum of Lisa wrote, "Delo amrinan shashvua chala ela kishehe'eni machmas ones dishchiach velo shchiach vaz chayv lispalish be'efer kedei lekayim shvuaso." He draws a very interesting distinction. The nesivos hamishpat, Rabbi Lorberbaum. He says, "You know what? There are two different types of ones situations." Okay? Ones means literally something that's against your will. You were forced into something. So he says, there are circumstances that are unforeseeable, and then there are circumstances that you kind of knew could happen. Right? So for example, I invested all my money in a company which had a solid rating, which had good returns for the last however many years, everything looked good, and then, out of nowhere, there's a discovery that they've been cooking the books, and three guys are going to jail for embezzling, and whatever it is. That is an ones where I had no idea. They had the best of reputations. It came out of nowhere. That's one type. Then, on the other hand, there's the fellow who invests in junk bonds, and he throws everything into it, or penny stocks, or whatever it is. And then he's really surprised when he loses his money. And he says, I can't believe it. We say to him, you know what? It's ones, in the sense that it's against your will, and unforeseen. But this was not necessarily beyond the realm of possibility when you entered into this. You sort of knew this could happen. That's the distinction that he draws here. He says, if it is, if the fellow becomes, he says, the oath is only an issue and is only going to be binding to make him say, pay up everything, if what happened to him was that he became poor as a result of ones dishchiach velo shchiach. Shchiach means it is found, it is common. It was something which is common and uncommon. You sort of should have known. But if what happened was something that is not normal, and you never would have expected to have happen. Adaita da hachilo nishma. You didn't have that in mind when you swore in the first place. V'lo chala hashvua klal. And the oath is not binding on him at all. Ve'enu chayev yoser mi'ilu lo nishma. He is not obligated to pay any more than if he hadn't taken an oath at all. What he's talking about is the fact that oaths in general, this is really a law about oaths, not a law about loans. But in general, oaths are not binding if your circumstances become such that you couldn't have anticipated this. And that's why we have the principle of Hataras Nedarim, the idea that you can actually cancel an oath that was taken if you go before a court and you explain what new circumstance developed that you didn't know about in the beginning. So, for example, a person says that he swears that he is not going to eat, I'm making this now entirely, so don't take any health advice from this. He swears he's not going to eat blueberries. Why? Who knows why? He took an oath, he's never going to eat blueberries. Then, lo and behold, his doctor says to him, you know, blueberries have antioxidants. It's been discovered now that they're very important and nutritious, and you should be eating blueberries. So, if he's within his rights to go to a Beit Din, to go to a court and say, I would like to have my vow annulled because I didn't know these were going to be important to me. I had no way of knowing these were going to be important to me. That's legit. On the other hand, if a person takes an oath saying, I'm not going to bathe anymore, he's no longer going to bathe, and then no one wants to have anything to do with him, he can't go to a court and say, I want my vow annulled because I never anticipated that was going to happen. Sorry, you should have known. You see the difference? So that's what he's saying here. This whole idea that the oath is going to be binding upon a person, and the whole idea that this oath is going to be binding upon him, and that he's going to have to pay out everything, only applies where this was a foreseeable circumstance. Dan?
Not against the, I understand it was just an example, but isn't there a problem to take oaths?
Yeah, in general, the Torah is against taking oaths. The Torah is very clear that you're better off not taking oaths at all. It's just an example that I gave. Maybe there was some real reason for him to take an oath against blueberries, but frankly, I don't know what it was because I made it up on the spot. If you want, I can make up more of a story later for you. Okay.
When you say if it was a foreseeable result.
Yeah.
Somebody with morals intending to pay back.
Yeah.
So you're saying it's a foreseeable result that he wouldn't be able to?
Well, it depends. It depends on what he did with the assets that he had. In other words, did he spend this on, let's say, if he spent this on paying his bills, and he said, my business plan for paying off the debt is that I'm going to work at a job, and I'm going to pay you back, and I'm going to use this loan in order to pay off the debts that I currently have. So if he had an income, and he could chart out that it's reasonable to expect he'll be able to pay back, then he's good. And if he gets fired, let's say, 2 weeks later, not because he was terrible, but because something that happened within the company, downsizing, the boss hates him, or whatever it is, then that's not his fault. That's an onet de lo shchiach. That's not common. But on the other hand, if the company's been talking about downsizing forever, and there have been rumors about his job going forever, and he went and did this, maybe the answer is, that's shchiach velo shchiach. It is a little more common, and therefore he can't really claim that it was beyond his expectations. Yeah?
There are some people who are smarter than others.
So I've heard.
Smarter people who invest in a good boss, a government boss, or a stupid one invest in and want to get rich.
Well,
but the person that he spoke about, he invests all his assets in the bonds and cannot even pay debts and get to sell everything. He obviously didn't anticipate that was going to happen. He truly believed, with his meager mind, that he's doing
right. That's such a really good question. We've articulated a distinction between two types of ones, the foreseeable ones and the non-foreseeable ones. But we're pretending that anybody can look at these and identify what they are. What if he's simply not a sharp investor?
I just want to give you an example.
But, I'm going to skip the example. Just
in the good times, I invested in some stocks, and one of the stocks I invested in was $130. And some of them were really good stocks, and everybody in the world believed it. And they went from $100 to nothing, including Citibank. But some of them went from 130 to zero.
Right. Agreed.
You can say that I was stupid, and I don't mind if you say that.
But you didn't borrow the money.
But it doesn't matter whether I borrowed the money.
Right. No, your point is well taken. I think the answer would be right. No, I think your question is a fundamentally good question. Do we gauge this based on your average person, or do we gauge it based on the person who is borrowing the money? Since the distinction that we're making here, the distinction that the Pesach Choshen is quoting from the Nesivos HaMishpat is, what did he have in mind? Did he intend this when he swore or not? I'm going to answer that we peg it to the individual involved.
Yeah.
I don't think it's about some objective standard. But I want to make sure to go a little further because there's a lot to do and there's very little time. So, okay. But now, we're going to go back to the top of the page, to Chav Dalet, the second line on the top. This is an interesting question. We've been talking for the last several weeks about the Sidur, arranging for the repayment of the debt via the assets of this person and keeping certain things for him. We've been only talking about loans. What if the debt didn't come about via loan? What if the debt came about because I hired somebody and then I couldn't afford to pay him? I hired a contractor to work on my house, and there's a certain amount that I owe him. And it comes due and I don't have the money. So am I now vulnerable to this same type of collection? And do I have the protection of Sidur? Right, that's the question. He says, Yesh Omrim, some say, Shebechov Schirus Adam Bekalim, that when you're dealing with a debt that comes from hiring a person or renting property, I rented something and then I couldn't pay. Imlo zakfan bemilva, ein bahem din sidur elagove mikomashi yeshlo. In the rule would be that the law of sidur would not apply. The person to whom I owe the money, the contractor, the employee, the landlord, whatever it is, will be able to take everything of mine unless it was converted into a loan. In the event that it was converted into a loan, then that's a different story. In other words, he said to me at some point, you now owe me $2,000. You know, let's call it a loan of $2,000 or $20,000 or $200,000, doesn't matter. The point is that once you convert it into a loan, then it's a loan, and all the laws of loans will apply. But until then, this is actually a separate financial animal, and the laws of loans will not pertain. Correct, and that's not called the loan.
Right. So anything you buy,
right,
you buy it on credit. It's the same thing.
That's exactly the question. How narrowly will we apply the laws of Sidur? That's exactly right. So if you take a look on source base on your sheets, the truth is I didn't bring you the pasuk I should have brought you. So I'm going to mention it outside of the text. Now, you know what? This is okay. These verses work too. In source base. This is from the Torah's discussion about loans and collection. To be a noshe means to be someone who has lent somebody else money and the other person now owes you a debt. So, when you hold a debt over somebody else for any amount, the rule is you are not allowed to go into his house to claim the item. Bachutz ta'amod, you stand outside. Ve'isha sharata noshevo yotzi alecha es avodachutza, and the person who owes you the money is responsible to bring out the item that he owes you. You have to respect the borrower. Let him do this himself. You can't go in. At most, an agent of the court can go in, but you, the lender, are not able to go in. You let him bring it out to you. So the language that's used here in the Torah is the language of loans, specifically. So therefore, take a look at Source Gimel. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, Yesh Misha Omer, there is a view that says, She'ein Mesadrin Bechov, She'eino Derech Halva'a, that you don't do Sidur, this whole protection for the borrower, if it's a debt that did not come about in the manner of lending. Kigon, for example, Schiruso, Uschirus Behemto, you hired somebody, you rented his animal, Ukayotzeboen, or similar cases, in Lozakfon Ola Pamilva, unless it was converted into a loan. Vekain Keshabali Parameha Arev, Sheino Kabalon, or another example. Let's say you lend somebody money, and then the person defaulted on the debt, but there was a guarantor. So now you want to claim it from the guarantor. Same idea. The guarantor does not have these laws of Sidur. V'yesh omer shegam be'elu misadrin. But then the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, yeah, but some disagree and say that you are able to be to do the law of Sidur. So you see that you have two different views that are presented here. Take a look now on your sheet at Nuntes. It's about halfway down in the... halfway down in the lines at the bottom. Nun tes. Everyone see it?
What is tes?
Tet, sorry.
Oh, tet.
Yeah, nun tet.
Yeah, tet.
My Ashkenazi pronunciation.
Nun tet.
I don't think it's on this page.
Here, let me see. Are you on the one that has chafei at the top? Chafei or chafdal?
Nun tet.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So he tells you to see Shulchan Aruch Simen Tzadi Zayin Zif Chaf Tet, which we just saw, where he says, "Umistaber lehuadin b'chov mekach u'memkar." As Byron noted, it'll apply also in terms of sales. V'hevi sham shtei deot. He brought two views. V'nira shayachol lomar kimli. So it appears then that a borrower could say kimli. Kimli literally means I hold. Okay, and this is what I hold. I maintain. The idea is this. In the event that there are two different views, both legitimate views, regarding a particular issue, and it's an issue that involves a dispute between me and somebody else, it's legitimate for me to say, well, I follow this one. It happens to be the one that's more favorable to me. So he says, the person who is on the losing side here, so to speak, the person who hired someone and can't afford to pay him, is faced with a situation in which there are two different views. One view says he has the protections that a borrower has. One view says he does not have the protections that a borrower has. So he says, well, I understood. This is the magic of Kingly. I understood that the law follows the favorable one. The one who says, I do have the protections. So he says, yeah, you could do that. You could say, that's my posik. That's my rabbi, so to speak. Now, why is this subject to debate? What is this debate about? So, take a look, please, at source Dalet, and you'll see why. This is a Gemara in Gittin. It's dealing with a law that's going to be relevant in the Jewish world in another year. The law is the law of Shemitah. Every 7 years, at the end of the seventh year, loans that are already due, not loans that are not yet due, but loans that are already due, are canceled. Someone owed me money, gone. That's the rule. So, that's true for loans. The Gemara here asks, what about a ketubah? Under the terms of the ketubah, when a man and a woman get married, the rules are that in the event that the man dies, or in the event that there's a divorce, the man owes a certain amount of money, or his estate owes a certain amount of money to his former wife. That's what the ketubah says. That's the guts of a ketubah, is the obligations that he has there during marriage and the debt in the event that in the event of his death or of divorce. So, question is this. Let's say, in fact, the man died or they were divorced. And then Shemitah, the seventh year, happened. Is the debt via the ketubah, which is not a normal loan, but is the debt via the ketubah nullified by Shemitah? That's the question the Gemara is dealing with. So the passage says, Me'ematai ketubah meshametet, or Me'ematai ketubah meshametet. From when is the ketubah canceled? Rav Amar, Mishatifgom v'tizgov. So Rav says, the ketubah is not canceled by Shemitah. The only way it will be canceled will be if the former wife already took part of the payment and converted the rest of it into a normal debt. Like I talked about happening before with some of the other potential debts. Where she says, okay, he owes me, I don't know, $100,000. I'm taking $10,000 now, and the rest of the $90,000 is a loan. If you do that, then that can be canceled by Shemitah. But a ketubah itself cannot be canceled by Shemitah. That's his position. Ushmuel Amar, and Shmuel said, no. Pagma afa pishalo zakfa, zakfa afa pishalo pagma. He says, whether she took from it a little bit and didn't create a debt out of the rest of it, but simply said, retained it as the ketubah, or she turned the whole thing into a loan without taking any of it, either way, it can be nullified by Shemitah. That's not so important for us. What is important for us is what the Vilna Gaon points out in source He. He comments on this view that says that you do sidur on behalf of all debtors, even if it didn't come about via a loan. And he says, "Mi de misadrin biktuva kanal." He says, "I can prove that to you because the Shulchan Aruch says that in the event that a man cannot pay the ketuva that he owes, the rule is that we are misadir. We arrange for him to keep certain items." So he says, we do that. Uktuva eina kemilva im lo zakfan alav kamosha kasev lein in shvias. He says, we see from the discussion regarding Shemitah that ketubah, it does not equal loan. From the fact that they have a whole discussion about whether Shemitah will cancel the ketubah, and they say it will if it's been turned into a debt, that tells you that a ketubah is not viewed as a normal debt. And yet, we say regarding ketubah that sidur applies. So sidur applies to ketubah. Sidur applies also to all other non-loan forms of debt. That's the assumption that he says underlies this view. You follow? He says you have loans. What he's assuming is that all non-loans are automatically in the same class. That's the assumption that's underlying this. And therefore, whatever you're going to say for ketubah is going to apply to a debt that comes from sales, to a debt that comes from rentals, to a, you know, debt that comes from hiring someone, whatever it is. He's assuming that whatever applies to ketubah is going to apply to all of those. That's the underlying assumption. But he says that's the rationale. Okay. That's on that point. Let's go back into the text here on the page that has Chaf Hey at the top. The next piece he says here. The Kasav Bishar Mishpat, where we had left off in the middle of the lines. The Kasav Bishar Mishpat, the Shar Mishpat, which is the work on the laws of business, he wrote, Shem Yesh Le'echer Chov She'ein Misadrin Bo. Ve'od Chov Halva'a She Misadrin. Notel Kol Echer Chatzi HaSidur Ayin Shom B'Ta'amo. He says something which we're not going to go into here at any length, but he quotes the work Shar Mishpat to say, let's say somebody owes a debt to one party, and it's a type of debt that does not entitle him for sidur. Everything goes. But on the other hand, he has another debt which is available for sidur, which does protect certain things for him. So what do you do? So then each party, each lender is going to take half of the sidur. And he's, you know what, I'm not even going to go into it. It's going to take us too far afield. I'm going to hold off on that. I'd rather instead go to the top of the page and see Chaf Hey, because it's going to take us too far afield. Hisna imo shelo yisadru lo b'chov zeh tana'o kayam. Let's say the borrower makes a deal with the lender. The borrower says to the lender, and I already alluded to this before. Borrower says to the lender, I want to, you know what this is like? When someone buys a house, so there are certain ways that you can sweeten your offer. For example, you can waive the right to an inspection, right? Maybe foolish, but you can. You can attach certain conditions to your financing, whatever it is, things that will make your offer more attractive. Somebody wants to borrow money. He wants to make his pitch more attractive. So you know what he does? He says, as a condition of my loan, I am going to forgive my right to sidur. You can take everything of mine. That's what he says. I know the Torah licenses me to get it. I want to forgive it. His na'ima, he makes a condition, shelo yisadru lo b'choza, that they will not do sidur on his behalf for this debt. Tana'o kayam, his condition is binding. You'll see. And then on the other hand, if the creditor says, I will not collect from this piece of land, I will not collect this heirloom vase that's been in your family, or whatever it is, some say that is not effective. Meaning, imagine the following case. You'll say, well, why does it matter as long as he doesn't collect it? Here's the following case. I lend Chaim money. Okay? And I say, Chaim, I like you, and I know you really value your watch, so I will not take your watch. Even though under the laws of Sidur I could take your watch, I won't take your watch. But then, at some point, I sell the debt to somebody else. I turn to Dan and I say, Dan, listen, he owes me $1,000. I don't want to bother waiting for it. So if you'll pay me $700, I'll give you the thousand, I'll give you the right to collect $1,000 from him. Dan says, great.
Can I take his watch too, or not?
That's the point. This condition is not binding. Dan is now able to claim the watch, according to one view, he says. What we now need to learn is why this should be so. But that's what he's saying. He's saying in terms of the term that the borrower makes, the borrower is able to forgive his right to sidur, to protection. The lender, some say, even if he forgives his right to collect from a particular item, he's still able to collect from it. And therefore, if there's a successor to the debt, that person will indeed be able to go back and collect it. So we have to discuss where this all comes from, obviously. So, starting point is where it says Samach on the sheet. Samach is dealing with the first half of this. This idea that you can forgive your right to sidur protection. So he quotes the Shulchan Aruch, which is where this comes from. So Shulchan Aruch, Siman Tzadi Zayin, Chav Ches. The Kasav Hasma, he quotes the Sefer Me'iras Einayim, Rabbi Yeshua Falk, writing in, I believe, the 17th century, might have been the 18th. She'ein zeh kemasna amashakasuv b'Torah. He raises the point and the reason why I might have thought it doesn't work. The reason why I might have thought that you can't forgive Sidur is because the Torah gives you Sidur, and you can't make conditions on a deal that will go against what the Torah stipulated. That's what I would have thought. The Torah said you have protections, you can't give those up. You don't have the right to. So the Sma says, that's not a concern. Why? Mishum dahavi ki ilu bikesh sheyim cholo halova v'lo yivakesh lashir lo din sidur. All that's going on is that the lender is saying to him, I want you to forgive it when you have the right to the protection, but I want you to forgive the protection that you have. Uka Omer, he says, I'll give you an analogous case. It's like saying, Al menashal tashmiteni b'shvias. He says, I'll give you an example. We talked about canceling a debt in the Shemitah year, right? We said that at the end of the Shemitah year, all debts that are outstanding are canceled. If a person borrows money from somebody else and says, I am borrowing it on condition that you will not cancel the debt. It's really the lender who says this. That you will not cancel the debt on me in Shemitah. So the rule is, that works. Your condition is valid, and the loan survives Shemitah. Why? Lefi shatnayhu al halove, because it's the borrower's condition. Masha'ein kein kisha omer, al menas shalo yehe b'chov zeh din sidur, tana'o batel. As opposed to if you make a condition that says, sidur doesn't exist for this debt, that's different. Dehavi ka omer, I'm just going to finish the line in here, and then I'll explain. He says, look at it this way. And I'm gonna stop with that. So let's just make sure we get this point. He says, there are two different ways that you can try to nullify the power of Shemitah to cancel a debt. One way is to say, on condition that Shemitah will not cancel my debt. The other way is, on condition that you won't accept Shemitah's cancellation of the debt. You see the difference? If you use the former language, you're saying Shemitah doesn't work. You can't do that. It works. It's in the Torah. But if you simply say, yes, Shemitah's going to license you to abscond and not pay. However, I want you to agree not to do that. That's legitimate. That works. All you're doing is saying to him, yes, you have the right, but I'm not giving you the money if you're going to exercise that right.
And if he sells the loan to somebody else, then what happens? Do they have to respect that? Or?
Yeah, well, they would have to respect it because it was a condition of the original loan.
What about the wadj, though? Because that was a condition as well, but they don't have to respect it.
So I have to get to the second half, but it's not going to be this week. That's going to be next week. It's a good question.
This is a follow-on.
Sorry? Yes.
Follow-on next week.
Yeah. We'll have to.
The last one, right?
Next week is the last one for the series. But that's the first way. The other way, now I'm sorry, not the other way. That now applying it to our discussion here. In the event that you said, on condition that there is no sidur, that's meaningless. There is sidur, the Torah says it. But if you say, I don't want you to exercise your right to sidur, Mr. Borrower, I don't want you to demand 12 months worth of clothing, the right to keep the tools of your trade, etc., etc., that's legit. And if he says, I'm good with that, that's his choice. And the loan will go forward, and then he won't have the right to sidur. So that's the distinction that we're making over here. We still have to see the second half, the question of then why would you entertain the possibility that it doesn't work the other way? So that, God willing, we'll do next week.